Extra, extra, read all about it.
RandomChatter.com presents...
Agent Carter, you are going to run S.H.I.E.L.D.
Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files.
I go to work.
With your hosts, Directors Shepard and Stolte.
You boys play nice.
I have orders for Agent Carter.
Calling all junior agents of the Strategic Scientific Reserve, it's now time for Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, brought to you by Western Airlines. Check out the new cutoff route that brings Denver and Los Angeles closer than ever before. Western Airlines, America's pioneer airline. Welcome back. I'm Station Chief Shepard.
And I'm Station Chief Stolte.
And tonight we bring you the continuing adventures of Peggy Carter as she fights for truth, justice, and equal pay. Join us each and every week as we marvel at Agent Carter and show you that we're in the know. So, it's actually not each and every week because this is our last episode for the foreseeable future. But I have a quandary for you, Josh.
Okay.
How can Howard Stark sleep when his bed is burning? His creation of midnight oil, I think, is weighing heavily on his mind.
I'm going to have to ponder that for a while, but I think right now that the time has come, you know, a fact's a fact. We need to get the show started and bring it back. That didn't even rhyme. I don't know. Sorry. Hey, I've got the lead singer's hairdo. I can't really do more than that.
You do have
sorry.
The lead singer's hairdo. You are a Peter Garrett lookalike, except for the accent.
Yes,
so.
And the coolness factor, but that's okay.
I don't know. You're pretty cool.
Oh, thanks.
Well, so we are going to be wrapping up the Agent Carter series tonight. So why don't we just go ahead and get into it? I think there's a lot of little things we want to talk about, maybe a couple big things. So why don't you tell us what the episode was here, the final episode of season one.
Yeah, it's kind of bittersweet for me because this was such a fun episode. I'm gonna be sorry to stop talking about it. It's been a great time. So, but this episode, the final episode of Agent Carter, episode 8 from our one and only short season, Valediction. That's a real word, isn't it?
That is a real word. I had to look it up. I mean, I kind of knew what it dealt with, but I wasn't completely sure.
Yeah, I used my Greek and Latin, you know, knowledge of. To kind of figure out what it meant. But,
oh, right. So Val from, like, Valley Girl. Like, you know.
Val Kilmer,
sure.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Okay, I see. And then, Diction from...
Dick.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, Valediction was aired the February 24th, 2015, and it was written by Michelle Fizikas and Tara Butters. So, if you're in the know, you might know who some of those people are. It was directed by Christopher Miziano. Miziano?
Miziano.
I'm not sure I should be doing the part where we have names. But anyway, it says here that Christopher Miziano is the younger brother of S.H.I.E.L.D. director Vincent Miziano.
Yeah, we talk about him an awful lot over on our S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast.
Yeah. All right, so let's break this down before we start talking about it a little bit. In the aftermath of Leviathan's attack on SSR and the horrific massacre at the movie theater. That was horrific. I think that was the most gruesome thing from this series, maybe. But
a lot of deaths. Well, yeah, that we saw, I guess. I guess the Battle of Fanao could be considered probably worse, but we just didn't see that.
Yeah, right. So after all that, you know, Peggy's urgency to stop Dottie and Ivchenko / Fenhoff / whatever we want to call him, but
Faustus,
we'll call him
Faustus.
So we'll call him Fenhoff in this. Sir, it's thrust into high gear. She is really, she's got to get this thing stopped right now. It's getting worse and worse every day. After Howard Stark turns himself into SSR, they discover that the substance that was in the tank that turned the moviegoer psycho is called Midnight Oil. And not the band, but the, you know, poisonous gas.
Exactly. It's
a failed chemical that Howard developed for the army. So because he felt very responsible, he did offer himself up for bait to draw out the very vindictive Leviathan agents. They are very angry at him. Believe it or not, that plan goes horribly wrong.
What?
I know, that was a shocker, wasn't it?
Oh, my gosh.
And Howard's kidnapped and taken to one of his own secret hangars, where Dottie and our hypnotic doctor put Howard in a trance and send him on his way to release the toxin on New York.
Oh, no.
I know. Peggy and the boys get the upper hand on the bad guys, though, but they do have to stop Howard before it's too late, even if that means Jarvis is going to have to shoot him down.
That was a great sequence. I like seeing Jarvis kind of taking control in the airplane there.
It was a good ending, and it kind of reflected another dramatic ending from a Marvel franchise.
We might have to discuss that.
Yeah,
that sounds like a good idea. Well, as I mentioned earlier, this is the last episode of Agent Carter for now. The producers, Michelle Fazekas and Tara Butters, that we mentioned earlier, that were the writers of this episode, have been doing a number of different interviews. We've posted a couple on our Facebook page at facebook.com/agentspodcast. And there are numerous interviews with them following Agent Carter, some on like comicbook.com, some on comic book resources. Entertainment Weekly had one, I believe, as well. They've got a lot of ideas for season two, but there's no confirmation that we're going to be getting one. But they definitely have ideas about what they would want to do should they be given the opportunity. So, and of course, I think Josh, you probably will agree, they teed up a number of different potential next steps from this series as they wrapped up a lot of things. They opened up a couple other little cans of worms that potentially could work into a second season and beyond.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and continue with further character development. I thought they had a good basis for some new and interesting things with the characters, you know, particularly with like Sousa and Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just some other possibilities. So I like that they wrapped it up, but it was really just kind of like wrapping up a case. There's plenty more that they could go for.
Right. And if this were to be the last, you know, the end of any Agent Carter series that ABC decides they don't want to pick it up, I don't know why they would choose to not do that. It seems like a great, you know, mid-season series that they can do 8 episodes on, maybe 10, and slot it between the first half and the second half of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's a nice little respite in the overall storytelling from S.H.I.E.L.D. But should this be the end, I think, you know, it wrapped up everything that you would want to know from this series. It's not like Twin Peaks or something like that where you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't understand a thing that happened. And if there was never any more, I think it fits in nicely with the Marvel Universe. But I would really like to see more episodes, just because this is the earliest we've ever... this and the Captain America, the first Avenger film, is the earliest we've ever been in the timeline for the Marvel Universe. And I think there's a lot of different cool things that they can be doing, you know, in this era to mirror or echo things that we know about happening in the rest of the Marvel films and in Avengers and Winter Soldier and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that they started getting some other Marvel, you know, tidbits in there, so that it's got potential to use even more of that. That got me real excited.
Yeah. And if you've enjoyed listening to this and you don't normally tune in, stay with us next week, because our regularly scheduled program of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, which follows the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. television series, which is on ABC, coming back next week. We'll be back to start talking about that, which I know you and I are both really looking forward to. I've seen the teasers several times, and I'm very excited for what the season holds.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited. I need to go back still. I've been into Agent Carter so much, I'm gonna have to go back and watch the last couple episodes before the break, just to kind of, you know, pump myself up for what happens next.
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing. I need to go back and watch like 2 or 3 episodes just to kind of tell, oh, shoot, maybe I'll just watch them all this weekend.
It's not a good, bad idea. It's snowing around here. I might have some time to do that.
Yeah, it's only, what, 10 episodes, so you can do that in about 7.5 hours or something like that, so that's pretty good. All right, so as you mentioned, the title of the episode was Valediction, which is a real word. It means an act of bidding farewell or taking leave, also an utterance, oration, or the like given in bidding farewell or taking leave, as in valedictory, which is where you get the term valedictorian, I guess, in school graduations.
Oh, there you go.
And people were valedicting all over the place in this episode, I thought.
Yes, they were.
So, and we'll kind of go through and discuss a number of these things. But one thing I wanted, I've been feeling this for the past, not counting this one, maybe the past 2 or 3 episodes. And I posted a little tidbit about this on our Facebook page, but I don't think I've been as vocal about this on the podcast, that I've really enjoyed the dialogue. I mean, the plot and the characters and stuff are all very interesting in Agent Carter. And as we've discussed, it's kind of a different pace in terms of setting up mysteries and payoffs. It's not a lot of excitement, but I think it is an enjoyable, it's an enjoyable the entirety of it is enjoyable as a package. And I think it'll be something that, you know, you can watch in the future, and it fits really well. I think this is kind of going to be how also they do their Netflix series. I think this is going to be kind of how Daredevil feels. There may not be, at the end of each episode, you know, very exciting things that will lead you into the next one. But, you know, in an overall story arc, I think it'll feel very...
Instead, it's intended to be taken as an entire package.
Yeah,
right?
More like, I mean, it's kind of like a miniseries. I mean, it really has that miniseries feel, but it's not overtly soap operatic like some other superhero shows on TV or comic book shows on TV. But the dialogue, I was really noticing, especially in the last episode in Snafu, when I watched it again for like a third time last weekend with my family, that there's just a lot of layers to the dialogue and phrases that characters, like Ivchenko was saying something at the beginning of the episode, and just the choice of words that the writers chose to have him say subtly mirrored other plot elements that showed up later in the episode. Or, you know, it's just like the way characters speak, you know, like certain characters might always have little verbal, the voice that they use, you know, some may always say thank you instead of thanks, for example. I mean, that's just kind of something really simple, but, and the writers were very careful not to give characters the same voice. I mean, everybody had a distinctive tone and voice, and there was something really kind of melodic, and I think it was intended to be, about Ivchenko's dialogue specifically. So,
For sure.
I just wanted to bring that up and say what a, you know, how enjoyable I thought that was overall, because again, I don't think I'd communicated that very well in our discussions of the show, because we've been focusing more on plot and character and stuff.
But here's the thing. So, you know, you and I really break this stuff down and analyze it, you know, to discuss it. That's the fun. That's fun, you know, and it's fun to listen to people doing that. But when you're watching the show, whether you're a casual observer or somebody like us that's, you know, really going to dig deep into it, you don't think about that stuff, you know, until later on when you're making a point to think about it. But if it did stand out, then that wouldn't be good writing. You know, it would be too obvious because it's not real life. But,
yeah,
you know, you mentioned that, you know, if Chinko had that very specific voice, look at Dottie. Look at how they made her just completely change character whenever she had to, disguise herself. Or like when she was talking to the cop to begin with, you know, and gee, mister, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then she can go straight into who she really is. You know, and then you got the agents who are all just, you know, they're all agents, but they have Sousa and Dooley and Thompson, and even think back into Krasminski, you know, they were all so different And it was very obvious. And it wasn't just the acting. It's like you said, the dialogue. So I completely agree with you. Very well-written show.
Right. And Angie had her own take. I mean, she was very New York about everything. Oh, my God. Are you serious?
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yep.
Which really fit the time and setting for this show.
Yeah. Just coming up with, you know, writing these the little blurbs we do at the beginning from the sponsors for our podcast here. It's not easy kind of getting into the tone of 1940s. I mean, you know, it's like one of those things. It's like you know it when you hear it or when you see it, but to try to create it is kind of foreign. It's really weird. It's like, no, that's not quite it, but I often don't know what I'm missing. So,
well, and in this especially, I think that was pretty important because you had to kind of balance that with Peggy Carter's voice because it was very much not New York and really not necessarily 40s specific, you know, just because it was a British accent and then you had Jarvis in there as well. So you needed those balance.
You're right. She was British. I thought she was from Jersey. That is so weird.
She was from the fancy side of Jersey.
She was from the fancy side of Jersey, like Princeton. So,
no, but you know, you had to have that kind of balance, and that's why you had your the characters like the agents and stuff that talked very much like, you know, your old time cops. But anyway, good observation on you. I wouldn't have even thought of that until you brought it up.
So, I kind of got a number of different. This is really Peggy's episode. I feel in some of the previous episodes, there was a lot about Peggy. I mean, Snafu had a lot to do with Peggy. But sometimes we'd go off and we'd see other characters doing stuff for a while. But I'm pretty sure Peggy was in, gosh darn, almost every scene, except for, like, the capturing of Howard Stark and his interrogation. But then quickly, you know, she got involved with that. So I kind of want to talk about Peggy and her interaction with a number of the other characters here. I guess first let's talk about Peggy and Howard, because Howard shows back up here at the beginning of the episode relatively quickly. Very humorous scene where every agent pulls their gun and tells him to stick his hands up, and of course Jarvis puts his hands as high in the air as possible, and Howard doesn't
and holds them there.
Yeah, you know, and Howard's just like, "Hey, how you guys doing?" So, interesting things I've been thinking about Howard Stark. So we've seen him. We've seen the character of Howard Stark, not just Dominic Cooper's performance of him in the Iron Man film. So Dominic Cooper's played young Howard Stark in the two Captain America films and Agent Carter here, as well as the one shot. But then we have a slightly older Howard Carter or Howard Stark character that shows up in Iron Man 2. Now, he was in Iron Man 1 a little bit, but they had a different actor. But the actor that portrays him in Iron Man 2, you know, from like the 50s, I guess, you know, he's kind of a little bit older. He's got whiter hair and he's still
looked like kind of like the Mad Men era.
Yes. I think he was played by a guy from Mad Men.
He was.
He?
Yes. Yep.
I don't watch Mad Men. I'm too busy watching all these other shows. But that actor is also going to be playing Howard Stark, I understand, in Ant-Man. Okay? So we've got two actors portraying Howard Stark in kind of two different ways. The younger Howard Stark, the Dominic Cooper version, is very kind of gung-ho, very much like Tony Stark. I mean, I think that is a writer's trait that they've given him, that they are going to write him as kind of, you know, a very flamboyant playboy, ladies' man, jackass. And the older version of Howard Stark is, even though, you know, he's probably in his 50s or so by that point, he's matured tremendously from the Dominic Cooper portrayal. And I see that transition happening in this episode. Howard, at the end of the episode, and not through his portrayal, but through Jarvis's description of Howard, is changing, and he's taking his first steps towards maturity with disposing of all of his weapons, failed or otherwise, I guess.
For sure. For sure. I like the way they're portraying him. I think just in this series alone, and you know, we only see him three times in this whole series. He's in the first episode.
Yeah.
And then he shows up again, you know, a few episodes back. I can't remember which one it was, excuse me, where Peggy had to hide him, you know, in her apartment.
Right. So for like five or six, I think.
Something like that. And then here in the last one. It's like he's there the entire series.
Oh, they were talking about him from the beginning to
exactly.
the end.
Exactly. Yeah, he was sort of the key. You know, he was the catalyst to this whole thing, basically.
There was an actor. I want to say it was like Laurence Olivier. He you know, said that he wanted to be a certain character in a film. And they're like, well, this person only gets like 10 minutes of screen time. And he's like, but my boy, you talk about him through the entire film. So he's the most important character, and it's true. If you're talking about a guy the entire time, even if you only have 10 minutes of screen time or show up in 3 out of the 8 episodes, I mean, that's pretty important.
Yeah, yeah, and that's kind of how I felt with Howard. You know, but by the end of this series, you can see how much he's matured. Now he could still certainly be played by as a you know, a playboy kind of spoiled brat kind of guy, and he could do that for quite a while. But you can see how he's growing up to be the eventual character. I'm guessing they will portray an Ant-Man, or you know, at least he was in that film in Iron Man 2. That was John Slattery, by the way.
John Slattery, yes.
Yeah, and you're right. He is in Mad Men. So
yeah, and. We get a little bit more insight into Howard and his psyche due to Fenhoff's brainwashing, and I guess Fenhoff kind of takes him back to the point at the end of Captain America where Steve's been lost, and you know, talks about Howard's biggest failure, which is basically the fact that he helped create Steve Rogers as Captain America with the Project Rebirth, but then, you know, they've lost him and there's nothing that Howard can do. And Howard, he seems really, not embarrassed, but, you know, he's really sad by the entire ordeal. And he says he's not a bad person.
You know?
Remorseful. Yeah, exactly. And he says he's not a bad person, but, you know, Fenhoff is correcting him and saying, yeah, you totally are a bad person, which I think really cuts Howard. He doesn't seem, you know, in normal everyday circumstances, he doesn't care really, apparently, what anybody has to say about him. But obviously, Fenhoff's getting into his, you know, into his mind and messing with it. So it's understandable that he gets upset by that, but do you think that Howard lets other people, like, do other people get to him if they say something, or do you think really he just kind of thinks everybody else is way beneath him?
I don't think he cares what other people think about him, but I think he cares what he thinks about himself, and that's what Fenhoff was doing, is getting him to think about the bad things he does that he regrets. You know, he regrets making this stuff that killed the people. He regrets making that vest. He's got a lot of things he needs to regret. Maybe he regrets not getting rid of it once it's been determined it's so dangerous.
That's the thing. Yeah, I mean, he's kind of a pack rat in that sense. He's got a vest that he shouldn't be keeping around. He's got this gas canister he shouldn't be keeping around. There's a number of other things that it seems like he just doesn't need to have, but he just hasn't gotten around to throwing. I mean, how do you dispose of this stuff anyway? But, you know, regrets, he's had a few, but he did it his way. So
he does, for sure.
But there is one person that he values the opinion of, and that's Peggy. And I think that, I mean, he says basically that he always cares for her. And I think that he also says that, you know, basically he can't say no to her. He always does what she asks. And that's really the only real relationship that he has. I mean, even though I guess you could say he's close with Jarvis, he's a complete prick to Jarvis.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. Here's how I would kind of take that relationship. First of all, as far as Jarvis is concerned, I think he would probably trust Jarvis's opinion, too. Maybe not always follow it, but I think he would trust it and
I think he'd listen to it. I don't know how far the trust. I mean, well, yeah, I guess he would trust him. He just might not listen to him.
He might not listen to him, but I think it would always kind of be in the back of his mind, you know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like you know, Tony Stark's Jarvis. I mean, the same kind of thing. he'll tell him how much his power is about to run out, and he'll completely ignore him, right? But he still knows. He still knows. At least he's aware. But as far as his relationship with Peggy, I think it's because she is honest with him. She doesn't beat around the bush. She's very blunt in the way that she talks to him. And that what other woman does that with Howard? None. There is no other woman. And I think he respects that because he sees in her the strength and independence. And I think that's what he respects. He doesn't respect those other women.
He may see a lot of himself in there because, I mean, that's kind of how he is. I mean, he's relatively blunt about things as well.
Absolutely.
So, but yeah, I think there's sort of a mutual respect or admiration they have for each other. Well, actually, I take that back. I don't know that she necessarily has admiration or respect for him because, you know, for her, he'll never fail just to be Howard. Like, you know, if there's, innuendo or something to be made about it, it's like, well, that's Howard's going to do that. And Howard's going to act the way Howard's going to act. But she does know that he cares for her and that he's got her back, I think.
I think she respects his, I don't know if this is the right word, his intentions, I'm fishing for the right word here, you know, but the fact that he is a good person, like he doesn't do things
out of
deliberately,
spite.
Yeah, out of spite, right? Right. So he's a brat, you know, but any maybe his personal life is not something she respects, but when it comes down to it, he's a good-hearted person. Does that make
sense? She likes the finer things. She just does not want to know what went on or around the fine things.
That was the funniest joke. It was
brilliant.
Pretty vile. That's pretty good. I like it.
Right, right. Well, and
subtle.
Right. I mean, it sounds like a very like Rosalind Russell sort of statement from, you know, some 1940s film, like I can't even think of what I'd be thinking of right now, like His Girl Friday or something like that, you know, that she would say. One line that kind of comes back to me is the line Jarvis says to Peggy about how he's loyal to Stark, but Stark does not own Jarvis's integrity. I don't even know that Stark owns his own integrity because he's culpable for so many things here, and it's he just is not thinking ahead. I mean, he's almost a child. I mean, and not like a teenager, but, you know, like a real little child where he just does what he does, and he seriously does not have any regard for the consequences. And I think that's what, to me at least, that's what kind of makes up integrity, is that, you know, you do what you're going to say and you think about your actions and, you know, it's kind of a honorable existence, I guess, which is what we see Jarvis doing, you know, throughout the series. He's serving two masters because he has to, you know, do what Tony or what Howard says because that's his boss, but he's always in conflict with his own philosophy, you know, morality and stuff like that. And so he, you know, does some shortcuts as to what Howard may want to have happen just because it's for the best of everyone.
Yeah.
And in this episode, he, you know, steals the last vial of Captain America's blood, which Howard stole from SSR, which SSR had to take from Peggy. I mean, that thing got passed around quite a bit throughout the end of the episode or throughout the end of the series here. But he gives it back to Peggy because that's what it was the right thing to do. Right. Because, I mean, my thought, and you let me know if you had any ideas on this, but my thought is that Howard took it back because he doesn't trust SSR to have it. But again, like Peggy had said, I think last episode, he doesn't trust her to have it either. And what, he's just going to hold on to it until somebody else breaks into his vault to steal it?
I think he thought he could maybe use it. I mean, I think that was originally in his mind, but
to do some other tests to try
yeah.
to... Okay.
To do what? For what? I mean, he said to... What was he saying, you know, to cure diseases and you know,
right.
help people. That's what he said, but...
I mean, I think in kind of in the Marvel Universe, at least with the cinematic universe here, I think the... What we're to understand is that, you know, they made a super soldier in the early 40s in Captain America, and then he was lost, and they were trying to continue making super soldiers throughout that time until the Hulk and the Abomination, basically, in that film, which was kind of an offshoot of the super soldier project. So, you know, in the comic books, they've made a bajillion different attempts and created a bajillion different superheroes and villains in the process. So,
yeah. Now you mentioned how, you know, Howard was keeping the blood, but I felt like there was something more than just keeping it for scientific purposes or whatever, or, you know, whether you're going to exploit it or not. But it seemed to me like there was more of a connection to Howard and Steve Rogers. Do you think there was more to it than that? I mean, was he keeping it for a similar reason for what Peggy was, you know, had her connection to it, that she really wanted it just to have another piece of Steve?
I hadn't really put that together. I mean, just at the time that he stole it, it was prior to him getting hypnotized and the whole discussion that he ends up having with Peggy and the... You know, him thinking that he's going to rescue Steve, but I guess
he just,
I guess that makes sense.
Especially in the episode where they were arguing in her apartment, he seemed very emotional about the blood, about having it and keeping it, and it seemed like there was just more to it than that, than just keeping it to use for other purposes. But I don't know. He seemed to have a connection.
I mean, Peggy and Howard both shared a very strong bond with Steve. And as Howard said, just not necessarily Steve in particular, but the entire Project Rebirth program was, you know, very much his undertaking, except for the parts that Erskine was involved in. But he was instrumental. Howard was instrumental in doing so much of that. And it's like the one gold star on an entirely blemished career of inventions. I mean, we saw in Captain America, the First Avenger, he's got the miraculous hovering car and then it breaks down, you know, a few seconds later. And he's like, didn't I mention this is a prototype or whatever? So he's never been particularly good at, he invents a lot of things, but they don't turn out the way he envisions them. And Captain America is really the only thing that has turned out well, and that may be what he's holding on to.
Yeah, that's true too. And I kind of got that impression from this episode as well.
Well, Peggy obviously has a very, very close relationship with Steve's blood, and while they did something interesting with the blood that I was definitely not expecting, I think it was a great choice, and it really takes the blood has been acting for three or four or five episodes here as a kind of a plot device. You know, it's like, oh, this is what everybody's going after, when in fact it's not. I mean, it's basically been a red herring, but it's you know, it's been providing us with a kind of a touchstone to the larger Marvel universe here for the movies. And the fact that she takes it up to the Brooklyn Bridge and dumps it into the East River, which was, by the way, probably the most beautiful sequence in the entire series. Just the lighting, it's kind of sunset, they're playing The Way You Look Tonight in the soundtrack. And it's just a private moment between her and Steve's blood as she says goodbye and then dumps it into the river. It was poignant. It brought a lot of closure to that part of her that, you know, we didn't get to see in Captain America, the First Avenger. And because that's how we opened on Steve crashing in the first scene of the first episode of this season. And so to have her kind of have that sort of closure while also getting rid of this, you know, blood, which if they don't do something like this, it's going to pop up again, you know, for some writer to do something with. And it still possibly could, right? There could be little super soldier fish in the East River or something like that.
Little shield fins, that kind of thing. So, hey, you said it kind of, you know, connected to that first episode, too. I thought also Howard's hypnotic trance of him going to find Steve, you know, in the frozen tundra out there. I thought that kind of was a nice little mirror image, sort of. Not a mirror image, but, you know, a reflection of the first episode.
Oh, yeah, where she's having to talk him down. It's totally the same sort of thing. She's distraught because Howard is, you know, while he's not crashing, he's basically going to his death. In the same, you know, in a similar fashion, and she needs to talk him down. And I thought that was very evocative as of that sequence as well.
Yeah.
Also, just as a quick aside, how crazy is it that a news story popped up this week, the day after the episode aired? I caught that you can actually bid in an auction on Winston Churchill's blood. There is a vial of Winston Churchill's blood that is going up for auction. They have no idea what it's going to pull in. But, you know, he donated some blood at one point, and they found it in their stores, you know, from, what, like 1947 or something like that, I think it said. And, you know, so I'm here, I'm thinking, it's like, well, what would happen if we had Steve Rogers' blood around today? And it's like, shoot, man, you can go clone some Winston Churchill's now if you want to. I'm sure a lot of people would not like that, but
yeah, because that would fix everything. Let's just clone some Winston Churchill.
Yeah, what's here? Their finest hour. So
that's funny. Well, you know, it was crazy to me how after you think about this in connection to the whole Marvel universe in general, Howard Stark and his inventions, and especially in this case, Finnow. The Battle of Finnow.
Mm-hmm.
My mind kept getting Finnow and Finhoff mixed up. But anyway, the Battle of Finnow, it creates this kind of butterfly effect, which is long lasting into even, you know, modern times from the universe, you know, and up into 2015. It's like, you know, the butterfly effect where one little thing affects another. And
yeah,
I saw an interesting one online the other day how the Buffalo Bills football team in 1970 were so bad that because of this one pass, they were able to lose a game and get the first round pick, get O.J. Simpson, who spent some time there, meet his wife, kill his wife, hire Kim Kardashian's father to be his lawyer. They win the case and the Kardashians are famous just because of that one bad pass, right? But anyway, so that's the butterfly effect, right? So kind of, I guess. They're all connected. Because of Finnow.
Right.
These people.
Because of Howard Stark creating this thing because some general said, hey, we need to keep our soldiers awake.
Right. And so now Dr. Finnoff and Leviathan go after Stark. They end up catching him clearly in this episode, and they put him in the cell with Zola.
Yep, Arnim Zola, our good friend Toby Jones from Captain America 1 and 2.
Right, and then he apparently, you know, we can speculate that he learns the Faustus method of hypnotism, or if that's what we're calling it.
That sounds good.
Which is going to lead to the events with the Winter Soldier.
Yep, I mean, it's they obviously, and I was discussing this with one of my coworkers because he is not watching Agent Carter, so he's like, well, so how does this tie in with the Winter Soldier? And it's like, so did they make him a super soldier as well? I said, well, he was being, if you recall, Bucky was being experimented on in Captain America won, and then he fell from the train. And at some point then, the Russians grabbed him, and they grafted the new metal arm onto him. But then they also had to, they froze him, and they brainwashed him using some method. And we know that Zola was integral to those brainwashing sessions with the Russians, which may or may not have been part of the Leviathan group that Zola was working with. But we also know Zola then came and, as part of Operation Paperclip, joined up with the United States, and, you know, was inside of S.H.I.E.L.D. working with Hydra, and so probably taught Daniel Whitehall the Faustus method, which he was using on Agent 33 that we're seeing in the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. television series this season. So
all of this could have been avoided if the Army would have just bought their soldiers more coffee.
Right.
Proving once again that coffee can solve many problems.
So so the GIs, if they had some Joe, would have been all okay. The more
definitely.
You know.
Definitely. Yep. GI Joe saves battle. The day.
Yeah. One other that was really cool, by the way. Thank you for leading us down that path. One other thing that I thought was really great about this episode, and it wasn't anything new, but it's just, I don't know. I like the fact that Peggy really just states the obvious. And it also, again, harkened back to the first episode of the season where Peggy, I can't remember what, I guess Thompson told her to file some papers, and Sousa got all upset at that. And it's like, I'm going to go tell him off. And she's like, you know, don't do that. Don't fight my battles for me. And in this episode, Thompson, who we'll come back to in a moment, takes full credit for the stopping of the kidnapping I guess people getting killed at the VE Day celebration. And Sousa gets all upset, and he's like, I'm going to go tell that senator, you know, what for? And she's like, you know what? It doesn't matter, because I know my value, and that's all that matters. And no one else's opinion about Peggy matters to her. I don't think that's completely true, because I feel like a lot of the words that the agents have used over the course of the series have hurt her, you know, and it may be more of a lack of trust that they have in her, or assuming the worst, or not assuming certain things about her. But this has been her character the entire time. She's very self-reliant. And I think this is just a good message for anybody watching this. If, you know, if you can look inside you and you know your value, well, then, you know, that person that you meet, or that coworker that thinks you're a jerk, or, you know, the teacher that thinks you're stupid or whatever, if you know your value, you know, that's not going to affect you. You know, you've got to have that self-confidence to know who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good message, but still sad that she has to kind of deal with that. But I guess she is, because even Thompson, even though he did this at the end, he does know what she's capable of, and he has seen that. So,
you know, if I had my choice between, you know, becoming famous and getting kudos for things that I do, or, you know, being satisfied knowing that I was doing a good job and letting somebody else take the recognition, I would totally want that recognition. No. I think it's, I mean, I think it's, you know, probably more fulfilling to know that you did stuff. And it's not like she doesn't get recognition for stuff. People recognize, I mean, in this episode alone, she comes in and the entire office of male agents, I don't think we've ever seen another woman working at the agency, correct?
Just the operators in the front.
Oh, that. Thank you. Good point. Yep. So, but they are separate from the men, right? They are.
Yeah, they seem to be a real phone company.
Right. They're operators, and the men go out and do the work, except for Peggy. But they all give her this, like, you know, not a standing ovation, right? They all applaud her, and you've even got some no-name agent, you know, saying, "Hey, good job, Carter." So she gets kudos. She just doesn't get, what was it, like a congressional award, I think.
Yeah, or but, even recognize that she was even in the room.
Yeah, but I don't know. Is that important, though, do you think, in the end?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, based on what she said, is it important? Because it, you know, it gets done anyway, but I don't know. I mean, are you asking my opinion? Yeah, I kind of do think it's important. I think
that she gets recognized.
I think the people that do the work should get recognized for what they do. And I don't think that people that didn't do the work should get recognized for more than whatever they did, like Thompson did. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it's important. But do I think she can handle it and deal with it? Absolutely, because she's a strong, independent woman. Most people are not. Most people are not like that. And plus, right. I think they deserve to get the credit. But
right. Are we still talking about the episode, or are we talking about work?
we may be talking about both.
Okay. So let's talk about Thompson a little bit. He looks over his shoulder as this senator is congratulating him on a job well done on saving the city and yada, yada, yada. And he glances back at Peggy, and then he goes ahead and takes full credit for it. And I keep going back and forth. I have different opinions about this. One is the guy's a jerk. Plain and simple. And then I think, well, he's just scared. And so he's doing the first thing that occurs to him, just like when he was fighting in Japan and, you know, he ends up killing all these Japanese people, Japanese soldiers that come to surrender. And, you know, everybody assumes that he killed them all trying to invade. And he went with that story because, oh, that's the easiest thing to do. I don't think Thompson is a bad person. I think he makes poor choices and does not behave well or does not react well under pressure. See the episode in Russia where he froze.
Or Japan.
or even his decisions in Japan. What say you about Thompson and his choice here at the end of the episode?
I would agree with you. I think he caves under pressure, and I think he probably had a lot of different thoughts going on in his head at that point. Do I recognize Peggy? Do I draw attention to her, or do I, you know, make it possible for me to continue to use her? In the future, in sort of the subtle way, so people aren't expecting her to be that.
You know, that's a really interesting point. I don't know that he's shrewd enough to be thinking that, but
I don't either.
That is a definite consequence and a positive consequence of the whole thing. Because if she were to get recognized, you know, universally, you know, in the media as the savior or whatever, that's her own undoing, because the fact that she's a woman is the best thing she has going for her right now, because of course nobody sees her.
Right. She can do things that she couldn't do if people treated her like everybody else, like all the men.
Right. And like, just like nobody sees Dottie. I mean, they see her as either a simpleton in that persona or as a sexual object in the way that, when she was seducing Howard, which, by the way, I like the way they set it up. We you know, he's like talking about his airplane vault, and he's like, "You should see what I've got back at my house." And it's like, okay, well, there we go. Then he takes her back to the house and shows her that vault, and that's where she gets all the intel about the devices inside.
So, and that was the Ida that we were looking for. Remember a
Ida
couple
Emke.
Weeks back? Ida
yep.
Emke, yep.
So that they connected all that kind of stuff. And then we've got Sousa here at the end of the episode, who has always been he's always trying to stand up for Peggy, because I think there is some sort of camaraderie between the two. Was it the last episode or was it this one where, you know, they were saying that. I guess it was Ivchenko saying this episode, you know, that people, you know, treat him differently, treat Sousa differently, you know, because he's disabled.
Uh-huh.
And there's probably a little bit of, he's probably got a little bit of guilt or, you know, resentment over that. And so he sees Peggy as a similar.
Oh, sure. They've got a bond because they share an obstacle that they both have to overcome. Her because she's a woman in this culture, and him because of his disability. Right. And I also think it's interesting how he's come full circle in this series in the 8 episodes, because you know he started off like this. They bookended that first episode with this second one, with him wanting to defend her, but mm-hmm. as the series progressed. He got a little suspicious of her. Then he discovered it was her. Then he got angry with her. Then he realized, you know what, there's more to this and I got to figure out more. Then he discovered that she really is the one doing the right thing. And now he's back to where he started. Right.
Right.
But he's got he's got more of an appreciation for her than he did before, and an understanding.
And what I found was interesting is that there's no indication that Peggy looks down on him in any fashion in the same way that the other agents do because of his disability. I mean, she, as far as I'm concerned, she doesn't see his disability.
No, she doesn't seem to.
Right. But yet at the end of this episode, when he goes to ask her out for the drink, he is very careful he puts the crutch behind him, and he kind of straightens himself up and takes like a step towards her so he can stand, you know, appear to stand on his own without the crutch, you know, and asks her out. And I'm like, he is just still not really comfortable with it. I mean, obviously he's interested in her in some sort of romantic way, because he's trying to seem like a full man, right? Not the broken man that he thinks everybody else sees him as, which, you know, Peggy doesn't. And
it's interesting, though. I didn't even notice that he had done that.
Yeah, watch it again, because he's facing the camera and he puts the crutch in front of him and then he turns around, but he keeps it behind his back.
Huh.
And I'm a little sad that Peggy did not take him up on the offer, but she seemed to have a twinkle in her eye about the whole thing, which, you know, is like, you know, and she, it's not like she said no. She said, you know, maybe later I have to meet a friend. But, you know, when you're the guy asking the girl out, that's just, oh, sure, right, you got to do your hair. I understand. No, I understand. you're bald, but, no, that's cool. So I'm really looking forward to seeing, you know, I'd rather see a friendship between them and just sort of a partnering with them, because I think that, you know, like you said, he's got this respect for her now that he kind of sees what she's got going on.
So you don't want to see them having a relationship, huh?
It might be interesting. And, you know, people have been speculating online that he may become Mr. Agent Carter, because at some point, Peggy's got to marry somebody because of what was said in Captain America: The Winter Soldier. But, I mean, I don't know. Right now, I mean, as far as everything that we've seen, Peggy doesn't need a man to be complete. I mean, she's her own character, and, you know, she doesn't need a man to validate her, and she doesn't need a man to love her. She's fine kind of being on her own, just hanging out with her friend Angie, which, you know, that's kind of the mark of what we're seeing is like a strong female character now, which is great. It's not a strong female character that then, you know, falls for a man at the end or needs to have a relationship subplot going on. It's just, you know, You got strong male characters that they don't need to have a female relationship, and so why do we have to do this with a woman? I don't necessarily see the need for that.
Absolutely, I agree.
Well, we got a lot of questions answered in the series that had been brought up. We as we speculated about last week, the importance of Fennow was kind of revealed with the Midnight Oil test, or I don't even know, it wasn't really a test because the general kind of did it on purpose, I guess. So we found out why Leviathan wanted Stark's invention. We found out why the guys had laryngectomies, whatever, the way their voice boxes were cut out. And why General McGinnis and Stark had such a hate for each other. Like you said, we found out that Dottie was actually this Ida and was the one who knew about Stark's vault and inventions and stuff like this. And but even with all those answers, where, like I said, from an entire looking at the series as kind of a mini series, it's all self-contained, but there are still those threads, that connective tissue that leads into a potential other series or other franchises and stuff like this, like with the Fenhoff and Zola meeting and at the very end. But there, I think there's some other questions that were raised, such as was Ivchenko the and Dottie, are they really all that's left of Leviathan, or are there more of Leviathan? Is that still a is that still a group, right? So it could
that's
just
still
have
a
been
threat for them. I think it's a threat.
That it's what? That it's not just them?
Yes. Yeah, that there are more.
You know
that there's at least one girl left from the Black Widow program, because they left her in Russia.
The younger girl. Yep.
And there were some soldiers that were there with Ivchenko, you know, when they took him back to the United States. So
that's true.
I think it's kind of a Hydra-esque group, maybe not as powerful as Hydra, but or maybe more powerful. I don't know. I don't see him being more powerful, but
yeah, I don't know. So there's some interesting stuff with that. We've got. Dottie appeared to have been incapacitated, but then, of course, she wasn't there where they left her laying on the wing of the airplane. So she is out and loose, and she's kind of on her own now. So, you know, what's going to happen to her? She doesn't really have – I mean, she doesn't have a mission per se.
I think her first mission is finding the nearest Walgreens.
get
some gauze.
Band-aids and stuff, yeah. Obviously, I think another mission is probably still kill Peggy Carter, which Peggy survived by sheer luck. I feel that that battle should have really have gone to Dottie. Dottie get points for technical and for being able to whack Agent Carter with the bat on the back, which looked very, very painful.
Yes, I thought the same thing. I'm like, oh, she's going to miss her. Oh, my gosh, she got her.
Yeah, that was pretty shocking. I would have liked to, I just would have liked to seen them go a little more evenly toe-to-toe. But, I mean, Dottie just seems to have she's just more lethal. I mean, just her training is, it's not just in fighting. It's like she fights to take somebody down and, you know, incapacitate immediately. So it's it really was not a fair fight, but it was interesting, definitely. So any other questions that you feel got brought up that we may not
Well, I can think of one big one that we didn't get answered that we had kind of thought we would get answered by the end of this is, where's S.H.I.E.L.D. come from? More detail about where it comes from anyway. You know, how did it get started? We thought we were going to see more of that, but we didn't.
Well, hopefully, I mean, if the series continues, we don't know really when in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, at least, when was S.H.I.E.L.D. founded. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously some leeway for them. You know, it's May 1946 at the end of the series here. So, or the season. And so there's definitely room. I'm thinking S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, doesn't come around until, you know, 1950, early 50s, something like that. But
early 50s? Okay.
Yeah. So there's still some room if they want to tell, you know, they have room to tell a season, you know, and have another season be the next year and do other things like
kind
that.
Kind of lead up to a need for S.H.I.E.L.D. That's what they're going to need.
Yeah, I mean, as more people like Fenhoff come around, they're, I think, like we discussed last week, there's really not, they see that the SSR is probably not built for that. And that's why they decide.
They don't even know where to put Howard's invention. See, they're leaving them out in the open and in the light.
Right. Upside down. Now, this one is fine. I would like to see them, if they are kind of using this series as a longer form version of the one shot, I'd really like to see them kind of retell the Zodiac storyline that they had in the one shot of the Zodiac formula, which is a really strong mythological story in the Marvel universe, in the Marvel comic book universe, that I think could lead to a lot of really interesting storylines. So we'll look forward to that. There is one other thing, and that would be how does Jarvis end up organizing the spice cabinet? I think that's good for at least one episode, if not two.
Yeah, I mean, you have no idea the kind of butterfly effect putting the paprika in the wrong place can cause. So,
well, is it smoked paprika? Is it just regular paprika? You know, it's a lot of...
Exactly. They kind of go on either end of the shelf. You got to keep them away from each other.
Right. And do you alphabetize it, or do you go by, you know, flavor? It's just, there's so many different things you can do with that. So, I think we've kind of talked about a lot of the character references. Obviously, we got to also see Captain America's shield. Lot of discussion about Steve Rogers and Captain America. He almost felt like another character in this episode. And
At least his blood did.
Yeah. And he was kind of, throughout the series, and the way Howard was being talked about, there was a lot being talked about Steve as well. So he was important to the series as well. The press conference with Howard, though, I think really echoed the press conference at the end of Iron Man 2, where Gary Shandling's Senator Stern is giving Tony the medal. I think there were shades of that here. I think that was probably a nod that the writers did towards that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Josh, it's for the last, I guess 7 episodes here, because we had one that got doubled up. This has been a really interesting discussion about the kind of the short form Agent Carter series. And I'm looking forward to doing another season if they want to bring it back.
Yeah, I was impressed, and I would definitely watch again, and I'd love to talk with you about it. So let's look forward to it. Just think positively.
Yeah, definitely. Think positively. And you know, if you guys are on social media, make sure to tweet out that, you know, that you enjoy the series and you'd like to see more of it, because that stuff does seem to matter. Like I said earlier, ratings were up on the last couple episodes. So I think there's a really good chance that the series will come back. If they know that fans are enjoying it, I think that's encouraging to the creators as well.
Right.
So... anyway, that's all we've got for this season of Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files. But as I mentioned at the top of the show, please continue to stay with us for next week as we come back to our normally scheduled Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files.
Yep. And if you enjoyed this episode and our little mini-series about the mini-series, then why don't you leave some feedback for us on iTunes? We would really, really greatly appreciate it. We'd love it. Hey, you can also contact us to talk about this or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Our email address is shield@randomchatter.com. Our Twitter feed is @agentspodcast, and our Facebook page is facebook.com/agentspodcast.
And beside Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, you can check out the other shows that Josh and I host here on randomchatter.com, which include Green Justice, an Arrow podcast about the Arrow TV show, and Scarlet Velocity, a Flash podcast about the Flash television show. All shows are also available in the iTunes Store and through Stitcher for Android or iOS. And if you enjoy this podcast, please be sure to tell your friends about us. So for Agent Carter of S.H.I.E.L.D. Case Files, this is Jay.
And this is Josh.
Until next season, bidding you adios, auf Wiedersehen, aloha.
This podcast is not endorsed by ABC Television or Marvel Entertainment. The official website for Marvel's Agent Carter can be found at abc.go.com. Agent Carter and related elements are copyright Marvel Entertainment, LLC.